So continue our rambles. Most of you were here yesterday, but welcome to those who weren't. We ended yesterday hearing what the Buddha had to say about Vedana. You remember, he was told that there were seven miraculous things about him, and those seven miraculous things were, according to Shariputra, to do with things like having been born while his mother was standing up, and important things like that. So the Buddha acknowledged that these were pretty miraculous, but said that the most miraculous thing about him was that he was aware of Vedana as it arose, as it remained, and as it passed away. Also the same of Samnya interpretation and of Vitakka thought. But for our purposes, Vedana is the important one. So, well, what we've just been trying to do in that brief reflective meditation is simply be aware of what feeling is there without reaction, just be aware of the Vedana. But I imagine that you'll have found it's not so very easy to keep attending to it. It's very easy, very quick. One's very quick to try and work out what to do about it, as it were, or try to work out what it's to do with, or to start reacting. I particularly think that's the case when you get more mental, as it were, rather you look at the mental vagueness. You start to, for instance, if you feel a bit unhappy, you start to think about why, maybe even to blame yourself a bit, and try to alter it. Very quickly, I imagine that some of you at least will have found that. But what the Buddha said is that we're aiming simply to see Vedana, the arising of Vedana, as a conditioned phenomenon. But it's not so very easy. And we're so deeply habituated to reacting to feeling, Vedana, that it takes quite a lot of work even to be aware of it. So, yes, I said yesterday that ultimately the need we need to see the conditioned nature of Vedana, and if we see it fully, experience it fully, see that it's conditioned, that's equivalent to transcendental insight. But it's not easy. It's easier said than done, a counsel of perfection, I said yesterday. We can slow it down and notice Vedana as it arises. It's very difficult not to pass into reaction, especially outside the context of meditation. Most of the time we're so involved with what we're doing, where we're going, that the reactions take place without us even noticing necessarily what sort of hedonic state we're in. So we need a lot of other work around Vedana. And that's what I'm going to go into a bit more today. But I'm going to start by just reminding us all of where we went yesterday, the ramble that we took yesterday. And those of you who weren't on the ramble yesterday will be spared some bog and some bramble. We got a bit lost. Well, I got a bit lost, all right. I went a bit too fast and tripped over. So, yes, we're looking at Vedana, which is the experience, you could say, or the sensation in the form of hedonic tone. It's that aspect of our experience which is pleasure, pain, or neither in particular. So it's sensations, both of the body or of the mind, that have a tinge of pleasure, pain, or neither one nor the other. So that's, that Vedana is always a resultant. It's never a volition or a motivation. It's always something that happens to you, however near or far the cause of it is. It's never itself a volition that you have, as it were, immediate impulsion over. it happens. Vedana happens. So you look at your body, you see, you can feel the sensations in your hand, for instance. I was talking about feeling the energy. I think it's quite a good way of getting away from the mental construction of your hand. You know, when I say feel the energy in your hand, or feel your hand, the first thing that will happen is a picture of your hand comes into your mind. But if you talk about feeling the energy, you're more likely to sort of move away from that to something much more immediate. You're trying to get as close as you can to the immediate primary sensation. And that sensation will have a tinge, a hedonic tinge. Probably mainly when you're meditating, it'll have a mildly pleasurable hedonic tinge, unless you've got some ache or pain or whatever. And when you're breathing, when you watch the breath, you'll probably find that the raw sensations of the breath contacting the lungs, the nose and the lungs and so forth, has a pleasurable tinge, I'm calling it. It's not ecstatic necessarily. If you begin to concentrate very hard, it can become almost overwhelmingly pleasurable. But we'll talk more about that in a moment. So and those pleasurable sensations, painful sensations if that's what they happen to be, are not something you decide to have. You can decide to do something that will bring about pleasurable or painful sensations, but you can't decide, as it were, immediately for those sensations to be pleasurable or painful. It's a karma vipaka, or a karma phala, which means the result of action. A primary distinction in Buddhism between those aspects of experience which are volitional, in which we exercise some will, and those aspects of experience that are experienced, which are the result of our previous actions. So Vedana is a vipaka, not a karma. It's very, very important to remember, because you can then just experience the sensations without any sense of moral discrimination. Just because you're feeling pain doesn't mean you're feeling you're bad, rather. I know this has been quite useful to me, you know, because sometimes one feels a bit upset, let's face it, maybe even a bit more than a bit upset. And you don't need to feel bad about feeling upset. It's bad enough feeling upset, if you see what I mean. But what happens is you add on a second layer, well, a habit I have, of feeling sort of bad for feeling bad. So if you recognise this is a Vedana, this is the result of previous actions. And under the operations of karma, they're being fed to us all the time. They're being fed as our bodies move through space and time, as we come into interaction with the world around us, and as our bodies go through their own internal processes, pleasure and pain will arise within the body. And mental pleasure and pain will arise as we come into interaction with the world around us, and as the results of our previous actions play themselves out in our minds. I'm going to say more about this in a while. I'm going to say more about karma. But what we experience, whether it's in the body or in the mind, is, in this sense, a resultant. It's a vipaka, not a karma. So that's the first and most important thing to grasp about Vedana. It's a vipaka. Then Vedana has three different forms, or comes in three different packages. Dukkha, Sukha, and Upekkha. Dukkha means pain. Sukha means pleasure, and upekkha means neither pain nor pleasure. A sort of neutrality of feeling, or an absence of feeling in the case of the body. It can be even a sort of numbness. Those three, dukkha, sukha, and upekkha, are experienced on the physical plane and on the mental plane. They're most purely experienced physically when the sense of touch is involved. When somebody hits you, you don't sort of decide that it's pain. It just is pain. It's a primary sensation. When the other senses are involved, it gets a little bit more of mind caught up with it. So whether something is pleasurable or painful is quite a lot to do with your own experience, your own past experience. It can be to do with your culture. You know, when you eat something in a foreign land, anywhere across the channel, you know, it's more likely to taste revolting. And when you come back to good old roast beef of England, it's delicious. You know, warm, soggy sprouts. Our responses are some foreigners in the room are looking revolted at our national dish. You know, in other words, the mind comes into our interpretation of whether it's nice or not. I mean, it's a whole weird thing, isn't there, around... I know that I lived in a community recently where somebody just couldn't eat anything that was coloured green. A very important person in our order. I'm not going to give away who he is, but he can't eat anything green. You know, and if something green appears on his plate, it has to be taken away. What's going on there? It's definitely not the colour green, is it? It's something, some sort of a mental association. And you know, we've all got our little fads. I'm like, I can't stand eating when somebody's peeling an orange. Stop, Sabuti. Don't go any further than that. The mind comes into play, takes the raw data of experience, and adds onto it an interpretive framework which delivers pleasure or pain. The actual greenness probably does have some pleasure pain content, but it's worked up into some sort of context. It's said in Buddhist psychology that it's only the sense of touch that is purely and primarily pleasure or pain. The other senses all have some admixture of mind. So these distinctions we went into yesterday, they're probably fairly straightforward, fairly simple. They're simple to understand, at least these categories. It's not always easy to understand just how much of pleasure or pain is involved. It's quite interesting to sort of play around with different perspectives on things, noticing yourself how the same sensory object can be interpreted as pleasurable or painful depending on angle of approach, time of day, whether you're tired or not, who you've just been talking to, and so on. You know, like a plate of food looks delicious sometimes before you eat it, but can be really a bit of a turn-off if you're if you're feeling a bit sick or if you've overeaten, and so on. So the degree of pleasure or pain, the degree of the mental element in pleasure and pain is not so easy always to determine. But I think it's very important we do quite a lot of exercise around learning to notice the hedonic tone of our experience, and to notice to some degree, you don't have to get over precise about it, the extent to which that is dependent upon mental interpretation or upon pure physical sensation. So you sort of learn to be more aware, more rapidly aware of what the characteristics are of the particular experience of pleasure or pain that you have. So far, in a way, it's quite simple. And if we could only notice all that fully enough and directly enough and immediately enough, in a sense, that the spiritual life would be fulfilled. If we could be really fully aware of the pleasurable and painful sensations as conditioned, just as the Buddha is, then we would be free of them. Free of them in the sense that we'd continue to experience them, but we wouldn't be reacting to them. They'd arise, but we'd be able to make, you could say, the most intelligent, the most compassionate response to them, rather than being driven by our reactions to them. But it's not so simple. And we need to start looking at those sensations as they arise from another point of view. We need to be able to discriminate them into samisa and niramisa. Amisa, which is the root word, or the principal word there, amisa, literally means meat or flesh. Samisa means with flesh, with meat. Niramisa means without flesh, without meat. In modern Indian languages, you sometimes find niramisa used for vegetarian, without meat. So that's it. But here they arise. It's a bit misleading to have these terms etymologized in that way, because really, in a sense, it's got nothing to do with that. What it means is those samisa are those vedanas. Samisa vedana are those vedana that are so bound up in your own mind with craving or hatred or just blindness, ignorance, that it's very difficult for you to stop yourself reacting. Niramisa are those sensations that come to you in such a way that they promote in you a response of greater openness, of growth, you could say. They open up to you the path. So what's being said is that some sensations, some hedonic sensations, will easily stimulate the wheel in you, the wheel of life. They'll easily send you around the nidana chain again. Some sensations will easily send you up the spiral, or more easily send you up the spiral. So it's said that it's extremely important, it's very, very useful, very valuable, to be able to notice whether the sensations that are coming to you are sensations that will prompt you to craving, hatred, and unawareness, or sensations that will promote in you shraddha, faith, and so on, and awareness. So this, I think, is an extremely interesting area. This is why I wanted to have these rambles. Whether I've quite got enough material to fill them out, we'll see. But no doubt we can go on a few detours. So look a little bit more closely at these sensations and how they come to be samisa or niramisa. Because I've said, of course, that vedana is vipaka. It's not karma. And yet the wheel and the spiral are karmically driven. They're volitional. You react as a volition. You respond with creative action as a volition. Do you see what I mean? So that you've got the distinction between vipaka and karma. So karma includes those volitions that send you round the wheel, and those volitions that send you up the spiral. So what we're saying is that some of these are associated with the wheel, and some with the spiral. And yet, niramisa and samisa vedana are vipaka. So how do they work in relation to volitions? Well, what they do is they connect with pre-existing habit formations, with pre-existing patterns. So, according to classic Dhamma, going back to the Pali and coming all the way through, we build up through our lives, and indeed through many lives, we build up habitual patterns. We build up underlying tendencies. The Pali word is anusaya, anushaya in Sanskrit. Some of you will be familiar with that. Very close to asava, which some of you will be familiar with. But anusaya means this underlying tendency. That's probably the best translation of it. So, the most simple explanation is in terms of addiction. You've got an addiction to alcohol. You've been drinking for years and years and years. Alcohol has become associated in your mind with a pleasurable release. So when situations are difficult, or even if it becomes really habitual, just with the absence of it, the sight or the thought of alcohol is immediately connected with an underlying tendency to seeking it. Huh? So you can see it in many, many different fields, that you set up these trends, these tendencies. Karma, you could say, is the wearing of grooves in the mind. It's so much easier to talk about this in India during the monsoon. Because what you see in the monsoon is the land is completely flat. The rain falls, and it falls very, very heavily for quite a number of days. And what you see is gradually channels are dug into the ground. And the rain, of course, more and more quickly falls into those channels and flows down them. So that's what karma means. It's the channels that are dug in your mind through repeated actions, or through very strong actions done even just once or twice. So repeated action forms these channels in your mind, and it very quickly you pass from the vedana to the action that that channel forms. Do you see what I mean? We too often, I think, talk in terms of karma. We talk about karma in terms of the external effects upon us. But I think karma is much more readily understood and much more fully experienced in terms of these underlying tendencies, that the channeling of our mind, the patterning of our mind.
Hmm.
They're very closely connected. They're very closely connected. I'm taking it from a different point of view. Yeah. Mm.
Can you just clarify a bit? But would you use commentary always?
Would you what? Sorry.
That person. So, like, for example, a strong action could be a strong action of the person. But what if it was a strong action that had an impact on their life that wasn't their action?
Huh.
That's still karma?
No. That would be a vipaka. That what that, how they took that, would be their karma. So initially, let's say somebody attacks you, and of course there's an immediate vipaka, pain, from the punching and so forth. But then in your mind will arise responses of maybe fear. Well, obviously fear, of hatred, of revenge, and so forth. So those would be karma. The pain that's caused, and of course not just physical pain, but mental pain, would be vipaka. Yeah? So the anusaya are these very strong grooves that are dug in the mind. I had a very vivid experience of this recently on a long solitary retreat. I talked about this here, I think, a few months ago. I was on my own for 5 months and completely isolated for 8 months, and that means that there's very limited external stimulus. So most of what is going on from inside. The environment is relatively stable; things don't change that much. I was in Wales, so the weather changed quite a bit. Well, from very heavy rain to slight rain, but. In other ways, that the environment is quite stable. So what then happens is you become much more aware of the inner environment, the inner weather, if you like. And what I found under those conditions was that I became vividly aware of the extent to which the things that were coming up in my mind were coming up under the pressure of karma. Images would come up, thoughts would come up, feelings would come up, and I could, as I became more and more still, I became more and more aware of the whole trajectory of these resultants. I could see where they started. I could see that, you know, I was plagued by old movies, bad old movies, often for some reason. And all the images you put in your mind, they stay there and they come out again under certain conditions. And, you know, I could remember going to that cinema, I could remember the circumstances of it, I could remember why those images impacted on me. Up they come again. You know, just given enough time, infinite time, they'll all reappear if there's nothing else. And there's a sort of strange kind of, a complex conditioning current that pops them up. And I became particularly aware of, anusaya, these underlying tendencies that meant that I responded to images in habitual ways. That image evokes this response. Fortunately, it wasn't all bad. I've done some good things, and those images came up in my mind too, and there were responses to them. But I must say, it made me much more conscious of how important this principle of karma is. The mind that we've got now is the consequence of what we've done in the past. When you sit down to meditate, you've got the mind that you've been making, well, certainly since you last meditated, and actually throughout your life. That's the mind you've got. And it will present to you the resultants, the Vedanas, of everything that you've done in the past. So the particular pleasures, the particular pains that come up in our minds, or even the neutral experiences, are often strongly associated with or strongly connected with underlying tendencies. So we need to be aware of the connections that there are between particular pleasurable or painful sensations and particular underlying patterns. And we need to do what we can to, first of all, just be aware of it and to prevent the reaction, but also to minimise our involvement with those things while we cannot be sufficiently aware to prevent the reaction. So that's samisa, but niramisa is it's not quite the same. It's not so much underlying tendencies, it's more inherent possibilities. Your mind is patterned by everything you've done in the past, but it has latencies, it has capacities that you haven't necessarily much developed or much cultivated. These capacities, latencies, will be stimulated to some extent by certain Vedanas, or certain Vedanas related to in a certain way. So the path will be stimulated for you, maybe by the image of the Buddha. When you see the image of the Buddha, that will be connected in your mind with the following of the path, whether by immediate association or by some sort of a previous lifetime memory, or just because of the beauty of the image. It will evoke in you a response of faith. So that will be the sort of most classic of niramisa responses. But there are many, many things that stimulate in us, or can stimulate in us, a response of a creative response. It's not that the image is necessarily, or the Vedana is necessarily going to send us on the wheel or up the spiral. You know, you can have images presented to you, or Vedanas that are presented to you, that are connected with addiction, for instance, but you can refuse to go along with that. You can even make them into bases for the path. But you need to be very clear about yourself. You need to be very honest about yourself. Can you, if you've had an addiction to cigarettes, for instance, really, you know, light up a cigarette and just hold it in your hands? I remember doing this when I was giving up smoking. I came across COD Zen, you know what I mean, sort of pseudo Zen. And the idea there was that you should be able to just absorb anything. You shouldn't avoid anything. So I thought, well, you know, I need to just be strong enough to hold a cigarette in my hands and not smoke it. I shall tell you here and now I wasn't, and I went back to smoking. And you need to be intelligent about it. You need to recognise that the image of a cigarette, the smell of a cigarette, is a samisa vedana that will too easily for you lead to renewed addiction.
I'm becoming a bit dense here, security.
Good.
Thank you.
The density is very good.
It's the desire unlocked, and it's linked to karma. I'm not completely clear about the desire that you've talked about as underlying tendency.
Yes.
And is that an underlying tendency? Is it a volition or is it a result?
It's a volition.
So it's an underlying tendency to act in a certain
yes.
way.
Yeah.
As a result, which, so when there is Vedana,
yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It can result in sort of being
yeah.
in which you have a mental construct of how you respond to that.
Yes.
So is anasaya an aspect of karma?
Yes, you could say that. It's a way of talking about the karma as a kind of aggregate.
Oh, I see.
Do you see what I mean? So that your karmas are each individual acts of volition, of body, speech and mind. But they kind of tend in a certain direction, which is what forms your character and your habits and so forth. So anusaya is a term for the collective burden of a particular stream of karma. But it brings out the fact that it's very difficult to resist. And it's this sort of digging a groove in the mind, if you see what I mean. It's patterning the mind. Do you see what I mean?
I do. So that brings the question of how much the karma is volition and how much it obviously is habitual.
Habitual karma is simply a department of karma. So all karmas, all actions that you perform, whether a body, speech or mind, pattern the mind and to some extent determine the Vedanas, the experiences that you'll have. But some karmas have a much greater patterning effect. Some of those are to do with the weightiness, as it's said,
yes.
of the action. to take a rather nasty example, I looked into this a bit in India, but you know, looking at domestic violence, what it's said is that the first time somebody hits their spouse, and it's usually a man hitting their wife, it's not that easy. You know, they have to be highly provoked, and then they do it. But once it's happened once, it's such a sort of weighty event that it very easily happens again. So weighty actions are of that kind. And I imagine there are some drugs that are like that, that the hit is so strong that it's you know, the first time you do it, it's very difficult to do. But after that, it's very easy to do it. And you can probably think of lots of things like that, that the action is a bit extreme. But once it's done, it's very easy to do it again.
Mm. By using the example of domestic violence,
yeah.
If you grow up in a household where violence is common,
yeah.
Conditions would become used to it. Like if you could,
yes, indeed.
Chris
yeah.
Brown, for example, said that he would never raise his fist to a woman.
Yeah.
But he did, because
yeah.
Not just because he grew up in a house.
Sure.
Also, but that condition
had. Yeah.
So to a certain extent, is that not the proper?
Yeah. Well, I suppose in the primary sense it's a vipaka, but of course it, as you say, it has a predisposing effect. So it must have some, well, the feelings will be stimulated in you, the responses will be stimulated in you, which you will respond to. But I'm not sure, I'd need to think about that, how exactly to classify that, as it were. But clearly some sort of karmic effect is there.
Born with seven grooves in us already. So
well, yes, indeed.
Some people come out happy and some people come out sad.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's how the Buddhism would deal with that, by saying that we've performed actions in past lives which predispose us in certain directions. So it's very difficult to isolate what those are, and one needs to be careful not of being either sentimental or guilt-ridden about it.
Say, for example, if one say that has a tendency to say severe depression,
yeah,
then it's difficult to see that as a volition, as mm. something that one is wanting or choosing. Oh. But you're saying it is that.
I think depression is an area which I don't know much about, but I would suggest that there's probably a discernible difference between the vipakic and the karmic element of it. You know, what I'm not prone to that myself, but, you know, at least feeling pretty sort of depressed in a normal sense rather than a chronic sense.
Yeah.
What I notice is that there's even a sort of physical sense of lowered energy, tiredness, weariness of the mind and so forth. And then there's a mental response to that. There's a volitional response to that. This is not a field. I don't think we should go into it further because it's a specialised field. But I'd suggest that you probably could isolate a vipakic dimension and a karmic dimension. And I would imagine that you have to work with that in mindfulness-based therapy. Am I?
Yes.
Yeah, good. I would have given you a full answer if there hadn't been a psychiatrist sitting in the corner. Yeah.
So you said two different things.
Oh my goodness.
Very
yeah.
clearly that Vedanas are vipaka, they're not karma.
Yes.
And then you said karmas determine the Vedanas.
Yes.
So actually the question that's interesting everyone hasn't been simply answered.
Well, maybe there isn't a simple answer.
Yeah.
Anyway, ask it again.
No. I mean, it's very interesting because in a sense, we're talking about responsibility, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're saying, well, what are we responsible for?
Yes.
What are we responsible for?
Yes, exactly.
But the problem with that is all linked up, in a sense, with blame.
Yeah.
And shouldn't the thing that we're really interested in be, so what is it that we're capable of changing, and what
yeah.
is it we aren't?
Yeah.
And you know, so for example, in the example of severe mm. depression, mm. We need to try and find some way
yeah.
of explaining it so that there's no blame for the severe depression.
Yeah.
At the same time, mm. we can recognise that it's mm. something we can dramatically change.
Yeah. Well, I think. That is what I said, actually, but maybe not in so many words. But that there's a component of every experiencing moment which is a resultant over which we have we have literally no immediate control. We may have a quite rapid control over it, but we have no immediate control over it. But there's a component of our experience which is volitional, where we make we put out motivations, if you like, and that is within our control, broadly speaking. But because of the strength of anusaya, it's very difficult to isolate the distinction and to make the change. Because the groove has been worn so deep, it's very difficult to see, to separate out the that over which we have no control and which is the result of what's happened from the past or from outside, and that which we have got some control over.
Is anusaya always associated with negative groove?
It is generally associated with a negative groove, yes. But I think there is, of course, if you're talking about karma, there is an equivalent which is positive, but I don't know of a term that's used unambiguously positively. So, for instance, in a way, I think it is, yeah. There's often been said that early Buddhism uses negative terms. I think that probably in the original Pali, they didn't have the same negative ring.
Because in a sense, our habitual nature is as much the solution as it is the problem.
Yes, that would be another point, but yeah. But there are for instance, if you do the metta bhavana every day, you build up a positive habit, you could say. So it becomes much easier to develop maitri.
But that's what you're saying with niramisa.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So niramisa demonstrates that
there is
as much that positive as
absolutely.
There is
Yeah. So broadly clear so far? So there are those vedanas, those experiences that with their hedonic tinge that come to us, that because of habitual action in the past, easily stimulate reactions of craving, hatred, or dulling out, ignorance. There are those images, vedanas, those experiences with their hedonic tinge that stimulate a sense of faith, of growth, and so on. Hmm? So what we need to be able to do is to distinguish the two. So, oh my goodness, time is flying when you're enjoying yourself, as I say. So I'm going to present you with the hedonic calculus. So this gives us some idea of the kinds of the different kinds of pleasurable experience, painful experience, and neutral experience. I may not have time to expound this fully, and you may be left hanging in the middle of... I'll do the painful one first and leave you with that. No, I'm joking. So what you've got is, first of all, a column with sukha, a column with upekka, the neutral, and dukkha, the painful. Then you've got a column which is physical sensation, mental sensation, what I've called aesthetic or mystical sensation, and transcendental vedana. Sorry, for sensation, read vedana. Which one? The left-hand side? You've got physical vedana, mental vedana, aesthetic or mystical vedana, my own terms, and transcendental vedana. TK? So, let's look at what happens on each level, and that I hope will make clearer what the difference is between samissa and niramissa. Although it's not even then completely simple. So the physical sensation is the immediate sense of pleasure or pain. A definition I read recently said that pleasure is what we want to repeat. A pain is what we want to avoid. And upeksha is the middle bit is what we don't have much feeling about one way or the other. So the physical sensation is immediate bodily sensation of pleasure or pain, or the sense of it's either a dullness or just no feeling. The mental is the sense of happiness that we have when we get what we want, or when we're going to get what we want, or when we're remembering when we got what we wanted. Huh? So it's when conditions stacked up in such a way that we get what we want, or we're anticipating getting what we want, or we're remembering when we got it in the past, savouring nostalgically pleasures of the past. It's interesting, in a way, I think that happiness as a mental sensation, a mental vedana, is often quite complex. For instance, when you're thinking of a bar of chocolate, you know, you're thinking of a bar of chocolate, and you're anticipating that bar of chocolate, and there'll be a sense of happiness by anticipation. But if you examine that experience, you'll find that there's also, underlying it, a sense of longing. You know that a child, when you're going to take them, I can't remember, the zoo or something like that. I don't know whether people do that anymore. You're going to take them. I remember, you know, I told I was going to go to the zoo next week. And you just can't wait. You know, is it today? Is it to zoo day yet? You know, and you're just longing for it. So there's a very, very pleasant sort of anticipation. But at the same time, there's a painful sense of it not being there yet. So it's a quite mixed experience. And I think quite an important thing to do is to analyse anticipated pleasure in that sort of way. I went to a boarding school, so I got really used to this, because you know, you're longing for the end of term. You used to do those charts with 7,356 minutes to the end of term, you know, ticking them off all the way through. So you're really longing for the end of term, and it's a sort of pleasurable thing that you're looking forward to. So in a way, when you think about the end of term, it's really pleasurable, but at the same time, you're really miserable right now. So anticipated mental happiness is often a bit more complex, and remembered mental happiness is also tinged with regret, nostalgia. You know the film by Tarkovsky, Nostalgia, all about the sort of memory of a Russian filmmaker of Russia while he's in Italy. And all the images of Italy are so beautiful, but all he can think of is the beauty of the Russian steppes and so forth. And a very, very beautiful film, but it's tinged with a strong sense of regret and longing. So it sort of brings out very clearly the happiness by remembered happiness as regret. But mental happiness is when you get what you want. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's often the happiest moment is immediately before you get it. It's as it were, as the chocolate is approaching your mouth. When it's in there, there's, if you're really honest about it, there's often a bit of a sense of letdown. No, I can see that there's some chocolate fiends over here, I know. Speak for yourself. Depends on the chocolate, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's like in India, you buy these bars of Cadbury's milk chocolate, and they just aren't Cadbury's milk chocolate. They put something in them to stop melting, and it really just spoils them. Of course, many Indians will not like our Cadbury's chocolate. I can't remember what my point was. I know I just spoiled it. Yeah, the pleasure of anticipation. It's often it's the moment of actual fulfilment that there's a purest happiness, but very quickly it gives way to something else. The mental experience of upeksha is not so much neutrality; it's actually dullness. It's a sort of emotional dullness, indifference even. It's satiation. It can be where you've just had so much pleasure that you're just satiated, or even so much pain that you're just satiated. You can't feel anything. It's a sort of numbness. It can, of course, be a natural mechanism. I think if you experience an intense shock, you go into a sort of state of upeksha, in this sense, upekka. Just you're not responding. You haven't got a response. And you can even in that state, when somebody asks you something, you just don't know how to respond. So it is a sort of state of dullness, which has many different causes. I think one cause of it is overstimulation. And I think this is a very key issue for a Dhamma practitioner, that we live in an environment which invites us to a lot of vedana. It promotes vedana, a strong vedana. And it's almost as if the environment sort of puts more and more powerful vedanas our way. And it invites us to compensate for drudgery, as it were, with intense experience of drink, drugs, very loud music, very strong visual sensations, visual stimuli, and so forth, to sort of overcome a progressive dulling of sensibility. So I think it is quite an issue for the practitioner in the modern city, even increasingly in the countryside. I went into a neighbour's home. I live up in the mountains. I went into a neighbour's home, and he had, you know, gigantic, I'm not even sure what you call it anymore, home cinema, I think it was called. And it was just repeatedly all day on showing, you know, really sort of junk movies, in my opinion. I like them occasionally on a plane, but all the time, and very loud music. Sadness, the feeling of mental sadness, is the sense of, it's where you are getting what you don't want, unhappiness, where what's going on is not what you wanted. It's, of course, the anticipation of getting what you don't want, or losing what you want. So it's insecurity. So often that kind of unhappiness subtly underlies our happiest moments. Even when you're at your happiest, that there's a little feeling that this can't last, this will pass, something will go wrong, and so on. So all of these three, these kinds of mental sensation, are clearly samissa. They're to do with a bringing together of a set of circumstances that provide you with happiness, or the having come together of a set of circumstances that cause you unhappiness. So they're dependent. They're dependent on circumstances. And the more you are looking for a happiness that comes from this coming together of circumstances, well, the more you're going to suffer, because those circumstances can't persist.
How does this relate to your first day talking about a sense of fulfillment, which is presumably a form of mental, perpetual vedana?
Yes. That more comes under the two latter parts, and I'll talk more about those elements tomorrow, if you can. Anyway, I think we're going to have hover around there, aren't we? Because we're getting timed out. Don't worry. The 7th Cavalry are on their way. So you can have the pleasurable anticipation of a solution to the problem. But what we've got so far, we've looked at the commonest experiences we have of pleasure and pain. And the neutral is somewhere in the middle. We have the pleasurable experience of physical sensation, and the painful experience of physical sensation, and just a nothing experience of physical sensation. We have a mental experience of happiness when the conditions have come together in a way that we want. And the mental experience of unhappiness or sadness, which is when the conditions that we don't want have come together, or when we fear the parting of the conditions that we want. When the craved object is with us, we feel happy. When the hated object is with us, we feel miserable. And so on. And in the middle, this dull state, I think, which is something we need to reflect on. I think that Bhante goes into this very, very well in Living with Awareness, his book Living with Awareness. I think the modern world promotes powerful sensation, and it sort of suggests to us that we're entitled to powerful, pleasurable sensation. And it offers us channels for getting powerful, pleasurable sensation relatively easily at a cut down price. Often people live quite alienating lives. They live in front of a computer screen. They live in an office block that is maybe, reasonably tastefully done, but that is essentially quite grey, not much contact with nature. And so they need to compensate for that with extreme sensation. I've noticed this word extreme creeping in more and more. Do you see that? There's sort of extreme something or other. And I think it's because of the dullness of routine experience. It is so interesting living out in the countryside most of the time. Last year I spent 8 months without even getting into a car. And, everything slows down. You just feel much more easily happy. Just more sort of basically bodily happy, as it were. The weather's miserable. It's Wales. I'm sorry, I hope there are no Joneses in the audience. I love Wales. I really do. Siddichi da iawn. You just feel it doesn't take so much to be happy, you feel more sort of fed in a basic way by the trees, the birds, the otter. I saw an otter come by, and so on. But in the city environment, you don't get so much immediate pleasurable sensation, natural sensation. So, and especially the way in which the modern city works, you quest for intensity of experience. So with that very salutary thought, I'll send you on your way to find some intense pleasure down the pub or whatever. Because I haven't told you how to get the other sort.
Thank you very much. Yeah.